Each year at Foundation Institute, we give our students a special group assignment in the comparative religion class. We divide them up, and each group of four or five students selects a Protestant denomination to research and present a report to the rest of the class. And one of the things that we ask them to do as a part of their research is to attend one of the typical church services for that particular denomination. Now, we always explain to them ahead of time that they should be honest about why they're visiting. They should be respectful toward those that they meet. And we remind them that they're not there to argue with anyone, but just to get a better understanding of what these people believe, what they do, but to get it from them instead of what somebody else may say about them. In some cases, they just show up and try to blend in as visitors, which is fine. In other cases, they may call the pastor in advance and explain, we're taking a comparative religion class. We'd like to come visit your service. And most pastors have had comparative religion classes, so they're fine with that. They don't have a problem with it. And it's been an interesting experience. Initially, we had a few people who were a bit concerned about the assignment. Apparently, they were worried that if we exposed our students to some of these things, they might get confused or some might even be tempted to leave the church. I will tell you that the one type of group that we avoid is the Pentecostal groups, because there can be other issues there that we really don't want our students involved with. But otherwise, I'm happy to say that we haven't lost anyone yet. Now, you might be surprised to learn, in addition to that, that many of our students tell us that it's one of the most helpful assignments that they have. They really appreciate it. And we were frankly a little surprised at how positively the assignment impacted the students. Now, Eric Jones and I team teach that comparative religion class, and both of us would be happy to tell you more about it if you are interested. But when we originally came up with the idea of having them attend a service, we just really didn't realize how helpful it was going to be. But you see, most of our Foundation Institute students are young people who have grown up in the church. And they have no experience with any other religious body of belief or practice. And many of them have basically assumed that all church services are pretty much like ours. Now, while each of the groups has its unique practices, it's been interesting to see the impressions that our students have gained from attending those services. They've attended a variety of different groups, from Episcopal High Church to a Black Baptist church. Some have attended one of the numerous evangelical megachurches that are all over the place. And one group even chose to attend a service of a group called Grace Fellowship International, which some of you will recognize used to be called the Worldwide Church of God. Most of the students have come back with three primary impressions. First of all, the first impression was that the people that they met were generally very friendly people, very kind, very welcoming, happy to see visitors there. Second, the students have noticed that in all except the most ceremonial and liturgical Episcopal and Lutheran churches, there is a very strong appeal to emotion, often amplified by subdued lighting and what has come to be called praise and worship music. The music is usually very loud, often with a fog machine. There's a strong beat, electric guitars, drums. The audience is encouraged to stand and wave their arms and sway and sing along. Not hard to get the words. There usually aren't very many of them. In some cases, the music takes up the majority of the service. But it is, in fact, the third impression that we found especially interesting and helpful where our students are concerned. And it was true across the whole spectrum of denominations that they visited, whether it was the believer-sensitive megachurches or the more liturgical churches. The students were surprised at how the messages lacked any meaningful content. There was little direct reference to the Bible, and if scriptures were used, very often they were pulled out of context or misapplied. Very little instruction on how to live the Christian life. A few messages that encouraged the listeners to contribute to the congregation so that they could feed the hungry or help single mothers or conduct a prison ministry or some other kind of community-changing activity. But they really didn't do much to help the listener know more what it means to be a Christian. Our students felt they learned little or nothing, and many of the messages were just basically telling them Jesus loves you so you can feel good about yourself the next week. They got the sense that if they missed a couple of weeks' services, it wouldn't really be a problem because they weren't really missing anything of consequence. It was going to be the same thing when they went back. And one of the unexpected results of the assignment has been that the students who grew up in the church and had never been exposed to other churches came to better appreciate what a blessing our weekly Sabbath and Holy Day services really are. You may learn more on one Sabbath than another, but virtually every week you will leave having learned something that you didn't know when you arrived. Messages that teach, the opportunity to learn during Sabbath services, was something that impressed me ever since the first Sabbath when I attended in January of 1965. I still remember that our pastor at that time, Mr. Hal Baird, gave a sermon, a very long sermon, on what it meant to have a Laodicean attitude. Now, I and my family had been attending a Protestant church for years. I liked my friends there. I probably would never have walked away from it if my father hadn't started reading this strange little Bible correspondence course. But in all my years there, I had never heard of Laodicea or a Laodicean attitude or why I shouldn't have one. And I remember leaving that service intrigued by the fact that I'd learned something that I'd never heard before. I felt like I'd been fed and that what I'd learned was something that was important. Now, over 55 years later, I'm still learning. I know that every speaker who stands up here before you wants to contribute to your understanding. And every year as we approach the feast, we think about what subjects we might be able to cover that will help all of us get a better grasp of what God has promised and what lies ahead after Jesus Christ's return. I can't speak for everyone, but I'll admit that I often feel very frustrated when I'm done by my limited ability to really capture and convey what is so important for us. I really identify with the King James translation of Paul's words from 1 Corinthians 13. We see through a glass darkly. It's a picture that we try to capture and convey, and yet our words just don't seem to fully get there. Hopefully we get closer. Sometimes, as I have done this year, a speaker will simply choose a particular aspect of our world today and try to imagine how it will be different during the millennial reign of Jesus Christ and the saints. I've heard some very powerful and moving messages through the years about a world where war has ceased. I've heard about agriculture in the world tomorrow, a world without homelessness, the economy of the world ahead, a world of real justice for all, the family restored to what God originally intended it to be. There's so many meaningful topics for us to consider that we could spend weeks here and never exhaust all of the topics that we need to think about as we look ahead. If a person can attend the feast and not leave inspired and excited about God's promises, then they really haven't been hearing. I didn't say they haven't been listening. They haven't been hearing. And that involves something else. But one characteristic of all those messages is the clear realization that we're not mere spectators viewing a new and wonderful world from afar. We are to be participants who carry out an active role under Jesus Christ in changing the world for the better. And the second part of our realization is that we must be learning now how to carry out our part in the future. Education in God's way of life is a very significant part of the reason God's calling people today. We dare not waste any time getting prepared. Do you sometimes stop and think about how amazing this calling you and I have really is? I mean, when you're a young person, a lot of times you look at the world and you imagine finding some way to change some terrible thing that's in this world. I want to be a part of changing it. And as time goes by, I want to earn a living. And as it goes a little further, I want to make it to the weekend. But we kind of lose that excitement about, I want to change the world. But do you realize that's what your calling is? You and I, professional nobodies, unknown to the world, unimpressive even to ourselves, are under Jesus Christ going to change this world in ways so profound it is hard to describe. And Paul tells us to walk worthy of our calling. That's quite a command, quite a challenge. So when, not if, you are given the power to change some aspect of the world, what would you like to change? What would it be? We've all read the prophecy in Revelation 20, verse 6, that says those in the first resurrection will be priests who reign with Jesus Christ for 1,000 years. In Ezekiel 44, verse 23, I found the title for my sermon, where God describes a priesthood, and he says, "And they shall teach my people." That's what I chose. "And they shall teach my people." I decided to use this time today to talk about a subject that's become a passion for me, and that's education. But not just education, not math, science, physical matters, but the spiritual education so terribly lacking in today's world. How will education be changed in the millennium? Now, I'm not going to talk about setting up classrooms and all of those things, but there are some other principles that I think are very, very important. Now, I found, and I know many of the other ministers have said the same thing, when I have the opportunity to give a sermon, what I like to do to begin getting it together is to gather all the relevant scriptures about it and to see what points begin to emerge. Because I often find when I do that, the points that begin to emerge are not the ones I had in mind. But that's fine. I want them to be the ones that God has in mind. And I'm often surprised at how many passages there are on a given subject. Education is certainly no exception to that. There are literally scores of scriptures that talk about learning and teaching, both now and in the future. Now, the example of the church has been very consistent. We have spent significant portions of God's tithes and offerings on educational programs. The most obvious, of course, have been Ambassador College, Ambassador Bible Center, now Foundation Institute, but there are many others. The old YOU program, summer camps, continuing education seminars, FI Online, an amazing resource that is often neglected. You know, one of the things that we see when we look at FI Online is that when a new section starts, we have a surge of people who are watching. And as it goes by, it drops down and down and down, and we end up with probably, for any of the segments that we have, and we have over 200 of them, it drops to about 400 people. When you think of a church of 10,000, it does make us wonder, are we really taking advantage of those materials that we have? We have many other educational materials that we publish, we place online. Life, Hope, and Truth is an amazing resource for material to learn about God's way of life. And it's not all for the world, though that is our target audience. You might also be interested in knowing that we do have a new Bible study course that is almost ready for release. Here is lesson number one. There will be 11 lessons in this. Now, I got this lesson, this copy of for display here. I got to give it back. I got this from the author himself. Well, the main author, anyway, is Eric Jones. So if you want to know about this new Bible course that's coming out, and we hope to have it out very soon, Eric would be happy to tell you about it and the approach that we take to it. It's not the old course revisited. It's a different approach, and we think it's going to be very, very helpful, and we hope it will lead people to a deeper involvement with the truth. But if you want to see them, those will be coming out soon, and Eric will be happy to talk with you about it. One of the main messages that we recognize in these feast days is that the world under Jesus Christ's leadership is going to be a transformed world. The institutions, the standards we take for granted today are going to be gone, and an entirely new system is going to be put in place. Education is a vital part of what's going to be necessary to bring about that transformation. Education's become so available to us that it's easy to take it for granted. The United States was the first nation on earth to ever make education publicly available free of charge to its people. It was said that in the 1700s, New England was probably the most literate place on earth because we were so diligent about making education available. But as with many things, when it's readily available, it's easy to take it for granted. Virtually all of you here have basic skills that you learned in the public schools. For example, unless you have perhaps inherited some kind of a visual processing disability, and some people do, like dyslexia, probably just about all of you can read. When you stop and think about reading, reading is an amazing skill. You are taught to look at strange squiggles of ink on a page and to translate those into instructions, ideas, profound thoughts. And reading enables us to share those instructions, ideas, and thoughts with others who may be thousands of miles and hundreds of years separated from all of us who are here. Yet sadly, we are rapidly becoming a nation of watchers instead of readers. And those skills are very, very different. They require very different skills within our brains. Nicholas Carr wrote a fascinating book a few years ago called The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains. And it's a fascinating study of those differences between watching and reading. It is not a diatribe against electronic media. It simply says we need to understand what's happening. I came across another one recently called Reclaiming Conversation by Sherry Turkell. And I, again, found it absolutely fascinating to discuss what actually takes place, what's happening in the brain as we watch instead of read. Throughout this pandemic, there has been an enormous demand for entertainment to watch. But reading really hasn't changed very much. Oh, I won't say it hasn't gone up at all. I think it certainly has, but nowhere near the amount that Netflix and all of the other things have brought forward. The idea of reading a book instead of watching an electronic screen seems foreign to many. There was a survey a number of years ago where they asked a group of young people, college age, they asked them, what do you read for enjoyment? And the number one response was, read for enjoyment? Didn't even cross their minds. We're a people who prize the ability to read this unique book that sits before us. You probably learn most of what you know about God's plan from reading that book. But of course, we also know there's more involved than simply developing the ability to read. Millions of people can read, but they're not sitting in this room and sharing the same hopes that we have. While education is vital, education alone is not enough. In Matthew 13, Jesus Christ clearly told his disciples that their eyes and their ears had been blessed to be able to see and hear with understanding. And that is as true today as it was 2,000 years ago. The almost universal use of social media has made it painfully clear that our modern educational system has completely failed us. We may know how to read and write and do simple mathematical computations, but it's obvious that many people don't know how to discern what information is reliable and what's not. Even when the information may be reliable, many people lack the ability to properly think through what the information really means. How do we use it? Millions of people around the world have embraced some of the most unbelievable conspiracy theories. Many people believe the earth is flat. Elvis is alive. Nicolas Cage is really a time-traveling vampire. Or my personal favorite, the moon is not real. It is a giant hologram being projected up there, but we don't know by whom or from where. Now, those ideas can be funny, and I intended them to be. And they're certainly relatively harmless to us. But what about when those false beliefs are matters of life and death for the believer or for others? What about when people accept and advocate false beliefs about God and his plan and his way of life? Because Scripture shows us that is exactly what man has done and is still doing. Have you ever tried to convince a self-deceived person that they're wrong? Well, welcome to your new job, because that's what we're going to be doing after Jesus Christ returns. My wife and I had the time yesterday, along with Mr. Jones and his mother, we went down to the Ark Encounter. And it was fascinating. It was an interesting thing. They have a lot of young earth ideas and some things that we certainly wouldn't agree with. But Mr. Jones and I were looking at a couple of the postings that they had there. And one of them was really quite interesting because it talked about why is the penalty of sin death? And the poster said, well, can you imagine how terrible it would be to live forever in a condition where there was all this suffering and so on going on? That would be terrible. So God said death was the penalty for sin. And I thought, this is a group of people that doesn't believe that. I mean, this group does. I'm not saying you don't. But the people who put that ark together, no, they believe heaven and hell. In fact, they had a big poster up there with a big dragon around it that said, if I can convince you the flood's not real, I can convince you that heaven and hell aren't real. Okay. but you look at it and you think, oh, wait a minute. On the one hand, you're saying heaven, hell, and then you put this up there, which is absolutely true, but somehow you're able to believe both of those? Strange. And those are serious matters. To believe those things that are wrong. At the beginning of 2 Timothy chapter 3, Paul wrote a chilling description of life in the last days when the predominant outlook, the focus of life, would be self-love and the many ways it's manifested. Are you a self-loving person? One of the things that I had to think about, and I'm still trying to figure if I can put together a sermon on it sometime, but one of the things that I've had to recognize through all of this pandemic thing is I like to be comfortable. In fact, I like it too much. I don't like to be uncomfortable doing something or not able to do something. And I've had to realize, you know what, that's not right. We're not called to be comfortable. So when we look at those listings of what Paul said this end time would be like and the self-love, some of those descriptions, if we think about them, actually sting a bit. God knew exactly where man's self-centered thinking would lead him. I want to just quote one brief verse from the prophet Hosea. He's before Habakkuk. But the prophet Hosea, and I'm just going to quote one verse, so you may not want to turn there. Hosea 4 and verse 1. Here's what God inspired Hosea to say. Hear the word of the Lord, you children of Israel, for the Lord brings a charge against the inhabitants of the land. Here's God's charge. There is no truth or mercy or knowledge of God in the land. Is that a description of our land? Is that a description of our age? There's never been a time in history when so much information was available to the average person. But much of that information is biased, distorted, and often completely false. Our schools teach that truth itself is relative. What's true for one person at one time may not be true for someone else at another time. There's no truth. Rioting, racism, abuse at all levels powerfully demonstrate that mercy is dead. And hatred and anger reign supreme in our societies. There is no mercy. Never in all of history have an educated people been so completely ignorant of God and His Word. God inspired Hosea with the right words. So when the task of re-educating mankind is given to us, where do we begin? How do you start the process once Jesus Christ has returned? On the first day, we read the passage in Romans 1, verse 28, that tells us that man decided that the knowledge of God is not something he needs to consider. So, as we read through the remainder of that chapter, God has allowed man to become utterly foolish and self-destructive. Now consider one simple yet obvious example. If a person believes that God specifically designed and created both man and woman, I think I'm talking to an audience that believes that, then we also believe that God designed and created the special relationships between men and women that we call marriage and family. And then we understand that that Creator's instructions concerning those relationships are of paramount importance. But on the other hand, if we believe that humans are the most highly evolved animals on a vast evolutionary tree, then we have to conclude that all human relationships are evolutionary as well. And if they evolved in the past, well, they must still be evolving, and that's perfectly all right. Relationships that have worked successfully for thousands of years, well, we can casually cast those aside because, after all, we're evolving. The binary nuclear family with husband and wife has been called the perfect environment for changing immature children into responsible adults. But now, it's viewed often as archaic and oppressive. Therefore, relationships between two people of the same gender, or even relationships between multiple men and women, should be considered families, just as much as the traditional idea of the nuclear family. For anyone to oppose such a relationship is just ignorant opposition to the facts of evolution. You're trying to impose your religious ideas on everyone else. You're not aware of it. That is exactly what psychologists and counselors and educators are taught today. So it's there. But this concept, at least, gives us a starting point for beginning to correct the problems. In the revolting litany of problems listed in the last part of Romans 1, if they are the result of man setting aside the knowledge of God, then it seems obvious the place to begin solving the problems is by restoring the knowledge of God. Man's entire concept of the world and how it works has to be completely uprooted and replaced. So where do we begin? Proverbs chapter 1. Proverbs chapter 1 and verse 7. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. It goes on to say, fools despise wisdom and instruction, which is kind of the extension of that concept. What a powerful message this is. The fear of God is the beginning place for true knowledge. This will be a shock to people who think Facebook is the beginning of knowledge, or Twitter, or whatever else it may be. Fear of God's beginning. What does that mean? This passage, and of course there are others that are very similar to it, make it clear that the kind of knowledge that's so desperately lacking in this world, the kind of knowledge mankind has willfully pushed aside, is built upon what Scripture calls the fear of the Lord. The fear of God is not just the foundation for an educational system, though that's certainly true too. It's the foundation upon which every single human being must build. You know, in Jesus Christ's day, Judaism had become such a complex system of rituals, a system so complex that there were men who were called scribes, who made it their life's work to be lawyers of biblical law. Great emphasis was placed upon the minutiae of obedience. When it came to the Sabbath, for example, all kinds of rules about what constituted work on the Sabbath. And you start reading through the limitations and you think, how does anybody come up with this? If someone cut themselves on the Sabbath, you were allowed to stop the bleeding, but you couldn't put anything on the wound to make it get better, because that was work. I mean, how do you think through things like that? You had to consider, if you're going to give your wife a bill of divorcement, what do you have to include in it to make sure that it's legal? Instead of saying, wait a minute, this is a marriage consecrated before God. Aren't we supposed to do more than just write out a legal document? They focused on these minutiae. When you read their conversations with Jesus in the Gospels, you get a couple of impressions. One of them is they seem to be focused on finding ways to do whatever they wanted to do without technically being guilty of breaking the law. And second, they were really disrespectful toward God. I don't know if you think about that, but you look at that, and I think you'll see that. At times, it was almost like they thought they could outsmart God. I can do it this way, and God can't do a thing because I did what he said to do. I did the letter. I certainly hope that we don't begin to think that way, and I'm not saying we do. Don't misunderstand me, but I'm saying it is something to recognize that, you know, the letter of the law isn't the whole story. Tune into the Bible study tomorrow night. What does the fear of God mean? Is it God's goal to have everyone terrified of him? Is that what the fear of God means? We sometimes wonder about that concept because, after all, no father, many of you are fathers out here, no father would want his children to be terrified of him. Yet, Scripture contains over 100 passages, including some that are directly related to this festival, that talk about fearing God. Deuteronomy 14, verse 23. Deuteronomy 14, verse 23. You know it. Again, I'm just reading one verse. You shall eat before the Lord your God in the place where he chooses to make his name abide. The tithe of your grain, your new wine, your oil, of the firstborn of your herds and of your flocks. Now, I'm going to stop right there just a second. I want to read the rest of the verse. But you understand what God is saying there? When it came to the firstborn, they were given as an offering, a part of it, we often said a part of the second tithe to God during the festivals. That means that when you brought a lamb, when you had a lamb in your flock and it was the one where the rod fell on it and it was your festival tithe, or it was a firstling that was given. I don't know that I could prove it, but years ago I was taught that the firstborn males went to the Levites, firstborn females went to the individual person, and he could use them for the feast. What God provides for us at the feast is lamb, not mutton. You ever eaten mutton? We had a fellow when we were in college who got a great deal on a bunch of mutton. And they served it to us in so many different ways. And we finally figured out the only way we were going to get rid of it is if we took it and threw it away. Mutton and lamb are not the same thing. God's giving you the best. That's what he says. When he deals with these firstlings, he's giving you the best. He's not giving you the old, the tough, the thing that, you know, you wouldn't really want to eat. You can put it in your pressure cooker and pray for success, but no, that's not what God gives you. He gives you the lambs. He gives you the veal. He gives you the young animals. Okay, but my point was the last part. You do this that you may learn to fear the Lord your God always. Okay, this is the fourth day of the feast. Are you afraid of God today? Is that what you feel? You went out to dinner last night and oh no, God's going to get me. I don't think so. Has being here at the feast made you feel jumpy? You know, your work. God's watching. Well, I better watch my step. I'm in trouble. Is that what he means when he says that you may learn to fear the Lord your God? No, we all know better than that. We know that isn't the idea in the instruction to fear God here at the feast, nor is it that kind of crippling fear that's going to serve as a foundation for godly knowledge. We understand that when Scripture talks about fearing God, the concept in most cases is more a matter of standing in awe of God. It's almost like our modern society has made it almost impossible to recognize God and stand in awe of Him. When I grew up, I always was inspired awed by the nighttime sky. You go out at night and look at all those stars and you feel so small. But it's a good small. It's not a bad thing. You don't feel terrible. You don't feel like, oh, I'm worthless. But you feel like, I'm so small. You feel like, in a sense, what David said there in Psalm 8, what's man that you're mindful of him? It's a wonderful experience. And yet we live in a world today where it's almost impossible for you to even see the night sky. It's said that 80% of the people in our country today have never seen the Milky Way. Never seen it. Now, I've read that and thought about it. When I was growing up, I saw it. When I was first out of college, we were in Southern Oregon. I remember hiking up into the mountains with a group of young people and camping out overnight in that sky. I still get choked up thinking about it. Awesome. And then I got to thinking about it and I thought, it was almost 50 years ago. And I haven't seen the night sky since. I've lived in all kinds of different places, and I really haven't had that opportunity. There's too much light pollution. A couple of months ago, my wife and I celebrated our 50th anniversary. And probably most of you would think it's a weird way to celebrate, but one of the things that we took about a week, and we just did a few things that we kind of hadn't done before, visited different places. One of the places that we wanted to visit, is since we're there in Texas, was the Paladuro Canyon. And that's the second largest canyon in the country. It's got an interesting history with the Indians and so on. But it's near Amarillo. And as we went up there, I told my wife, I said, you know, one of the things that, well, I told her before that, but I mean, I said, one of the things I really would like to do is I want to see the Milky Way again. I want to get out and see it. So there's a program called the Dark Skies Program. And it will show you can get maps to show you where it's the light is gone and so on. And we found that there was actually a place about 20 miles north of Amarillo. And we were spending the night in Amarillo anyway. So we said, let's go up. We left around sunset, and we drove up 20 miles into this very, very remote area where it was not totally dark skies, but pretty much so. Got there just as the sun had set and the sky was darkening. And we spent a couple hours just looking at the sky. Absolutely awesome. Yeah, I saw the Milky Way again. Felt good. It also happened to be the night where it was the best night for viewing the Perseid meteor shower. That was going to be at 2 o'clock in the morning. We didn't see it that bad. But we did at least see a number of the meteors coming in and that across that dark sky. And, of course, you can't believe how many satellites you can see going over something like this. But it was awesome. That's not been a part of my wife's background, but she found it that way, too. Very pleasant, very enjoyable thing to do. I don't think we'll do it every anniversary, but I'm saying that it was certainly a pleasant thing to do, to be awed again. That's when God talks about what he wants from us. The foundation of knowledge is an awe toward God. That's not just our interpretation. That's what Scripture reveals as well. When you read Hebrew poetry, especially books like Psalms and Proverbs, you often find many verses fall into certain types or categories. One of those types is called synonymous, and basically what that means is the second clause repeats the thought in the first clause, just using different words. Proverbs 9, verse 9, is an example of this. Proverbs 9, 9. Give instruction to a wise man, and he will be still wiser. teach a just man, and he will increase in learning. Second clause is just really a different way of saying the first one. It amplifies it in that way. But I want to look at another example that gives us something about the fear of God. Turn back to Psalm 33. Psalm 33, and again, we're just going to look at one verse here. But I want you to see the synonymous passage that's given here and what it tells us. Psalm 33, verse 8, let all the earth fear the Lord. Clause 1. Clause 2, let all the inhabitants of the world stand in awe of him. The second clause just says the same thing as the first one. But instead of saying fear, it says let everybody stand in awe of him. You see, fearing the Lord and standing in awe of him are essentially the same thing. Certainly, if we sin, we should fear the consequences of sin. But the passages that encourage us to stand in awe of God have a different purpose. Because when you're in awe of someone, it affects the way we approach that person and what they tell us. If we're in awe of God, we place much greater weight on what his word says. One of the things that I find is so exciting to me, someone mentioned to me the other day, they said, oh, I love the way you bring out the meaning of these words, the deep meaning of these words. And I was telling them, well, I'm glad that's helpful, but you know what? I didn't put the meaning in there. And the more I study, and this is one of the great blessings of being an instructor at FI, I have the time to go into things in detail that most church pastors just are doing so many other things, they just really don't have that same amount of time. But the more I study, the more I begin to pull out some of these amazing meanings that are packed into the Word of God, the more I stand in awe of that Word. It is absolutely amazing. It isn't like any other book in any way. And you stand in awe of it, as we should. So putting all of that together, what it shows us is that understanding who the true God is, how great he is, and consequently being in awe of him and his word, is going to transform man's way of thinking about what's true and what's false, what's important and what's not. And it's going to provide the true foundation for true knowledge to grow. When a person stands in awe of God, God's word takes on a different importance. Remember the account of God giving the Ten Commandments to Israel? You read through Exodus 20, and when they heard God's words, and they stood in awe, they said, okay, Moses, you talk to us. We don't want to talk to God anymore. We'll listen to you. Change their approach. I think it's interesting, too, and some of you may yet go down to the Ark Encounter thing, and I certainly would not discourage that at all, but there's a lot there about creation, of course. We do believe in a divine creation. As you go through those things, though, you find that sometimes the approach is not quite what you might expect. There are a lot of things there that we can learn and think about when we talk about that. But when you think about the beginning of the book of Genesis, the first chapter and into the second, the days of creation, how do you see that? I think many times we look at those passages and we see them as history. Okay, there's history there. But why does God begin the Bible that way? I mean, you look through those, and I don't have time to go through the detail right now, but you look through those, and it says, it begins by God saying, okay, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And as we understand it, the earth became chaotic and in confusion. And darkness covered the face of the deep. And then it says that God, the Spirit of God hovered over the waters, and it says, God said, let there be light. And there was light. And what does that tell you? I mean, when you walk into a dark room and you say, let there be light, does it come on? You don't have the power to do something like that. The world is covered in deep, intense darkness. And God says, let there be light. Bam, there's light. There's no equivocating back and forth. It's not this mighty struggle where it kind of gets light and then it gets dark and then it gets light and then it gets dark and then boom. No. God said, let there be light. Bam, there's light. That's pretty impressive, God. What else you got? Well, how about life from nothing? That's pretty impressive. How about life not only that grows out of the ground, but life that gets up and moves around and does all of the things that animals do? How about the heavens and the seasons and all that's built into that? By the time you get through all of chapter 1, the first 6 days of creation with human beings being the last of that pinnacle of the physical creation, you say, wow, the one who did all of that is the one who wrote the rest of this book. I'm supposed to pay attention. You know, if he can do all of that, I better pay attention to what's there. And then he tells us that he also has the power to make time different. He has the power to make time holy. Wow, that's impressive. Oh, I know, I've come across those people who say, well, we keep every day holy. No, you don't. You don't keep any day holy, to be honest, but you don't have the power to make anything holy. So, no, God has the power to do some amazing things, and that's the way he begins. He begins by putting us in awe, if we stop and think about it. And that's exactly the same principle we find in many of the passages that we read. We've read Isaiah chapter 2. Let me just go back and read verses 3 and 4. You'll probably hear it again before the feast is over. Many people shall come and say, come and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways. We shall walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. With the awe of God, and then that word coming out, that's profound. He shall judge between the nations, rebuke many people. They shall beat their swords into plowshares, their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. We often think of that in the terms of nations going against one another. But when you stop and think about it, human beings war against one another. We have to learn a different way. Not the way of war anymore. A few chapters further on, Isaiah 11, beautiful chapter, verse 9. Isaiah 11, verse 9, they shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord, as the waters cover the sea. What a magnificent passage that is. What a promise. How's that going to happen? Well, it starts with awe toward God. A few chapters further on, Isaiah 26. Isaiah 26 in verse 9. Isaiah writes, with my soul I have desired you in the night. Yes, by my spirit within me I will seek you early. For when your judgments are in the earth, the inhabitants of the world will learn righteousness. When the knowledge of God is there, founded upon the fear, the awe, the respect toward God, then people will finally learn what righteousness is. Today the world is filled with secular righteousness, with people who decide for themselves what's righteous, what's not righteous. Oh, eating animals is not righteous. That isn't what God's word says. That's not built on the foundation of fear of God. That's built on human reasoning. No, that's not true. People will learn righteousness. Now, the prophecies that we read so often show us that the first people to be taught God's way and to begin to receive the blessings of obedience will be Israel. Their response is going to provoke a reaction from the other nations of the world as well. Notice in Deuteronomy 4, again, we may not think of this sometimes as a prophecy, but it is. Deuteronomy 4, starting in verse 5. Deuteronomy 4, verse 5. Moses said, surely I have taught you statutes and judgments, just as the Lord my God commanded me, that you should act according to them in the land which you go to possess. Now, certainly that applied to Israel going into the promised land, but we're going in to possess a land too. Verse 6. Therefore, be careful to observe them, For this is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the peoples who will hear all these statutes and say, surely, this great nation is a wise and understanding people. For what great nation is there that has God so near to it as the Lord our God is to us? For whatever reason we may call upon him. And what great nation is there that has such statutes and righteous judgments as are in all this law which I set before you this day? He tells Israel anciently, and he tells us today, that when the rest of the world begins to look at his people, the people of Israel, living the right way, reaping the benefits, they're going to look at that and say, wow, your God is blessing you for living this way. Pretty obvious how to go about getting blessings. Live that way. The recognition that you and I are going to be involved in re-educating mankind after Jesus Christ's return is certainly not something new to us. Others have referred to Isaiah 30 that talks about the teachers of the future, you and me, not being moved into an obscure corner, but being there continually to help and to guide. We've probably all felt a twinge of guilty recognition when we hear the words of the author of Hebrews, chiding the Christians of his day for not being ready to teach the word of righteousness. And we wonder, how ready are we? Hebrews 5 and verse 12. Sometimes people ask me, when you teach at FI, what's your favorite book to teach? And I have to say, I think Hebrews. I really, really enjoy Hebrews. And in the midst of this section where he's talking about Melchizedek, he's talking about the priesthood, he's talking about the role of Jesus Christ, suddenly he breaks into this, verse 12, Hebrews 5, verse 12. For though by this time you ought to be teachers, you need someone to teach you again the first principles of the oracles of God. And you come to need milk and not solid food. For everyone who partakes only of milk is unskilled in the word of righteousness. He's a babe. But solid food belongs to those who are of full age, that is, those who by reason of use have their senses exercised to discern both good and evil. We read that, and as I say, sometimes, well, the old story is, as the shoe fits, wear it, and in this case, the shoe pinches a bit. Because sometimes we look at ourselves, and I'm not really ready to do this. These words tell us that the author of Hebrews expected people who had been Christians for years to have learned enough that they could teach the truth to others. But he saw it wasn't so. Learning God's truth was not simply for the purpose of acquiring more knowledge. God had a purpose in mind, the ability to share that knowledge with others in a way that would help them to understand. The people he addressed were not in rebellion. They weren't causing problems for the church. They'd simply gotten comfortable with what they knew and had failed to move forward in a positive way. All of their years of experience, pretty much useless. Now, it's certainly fine to take time to learn, but there is coming a time when we must be ready to teach. Actively teaching and actively learning require two different skill sets. If a student is not actively trying to learn, he or she's never really going to learn a subject. Just sitting, letting it wash over you, doesn't work. There's got to be an active involvement. As we all understand, you can only teach what you know. The best teachers are those who are actively learning in their own lives, and they're excited about sharing what they're learning. So how well have we learned the Word of God? Now, there are a number of theories when it comes to humans, how humans learn. But the most commonly accepted approach says that to actually learn something, we have to address three different areas simultaneously. Those areas are sometimes called domains. They have different names. But the easiest way to think about them is with the terms knowledge, values, and actions. Those three things. To know something, all of those have to be addressed simultaneously. Knowledge involves mentally mastering the facts. Values refers to how much value you place on the knowledge, how much you allow that knowledge to affect the way you live. And actions refers to how you incorporate that knowledge into your life. Each of the areas has various levels of accomplishment, starting from the very simplest, moving upward to more complex levels, depending upon how dedicated the student is to learning the material. Now, that all sounds very nice. It is very nice, I promise you. It's very helpful. But let's take it out of abstract terms and try to apply it in very concrete ways. It can easily be illustrated with scholastic subjects, but we're not here to learn about scholastic subjects. We need to learn about God's law. After all, God says that's what's going forth from Zion. So how well do you know the law of God? Now, I've often tried to illustrate this by looking at the law of the Sabbath, and it's a pretty easy way to do that. But I thought, you know, we've been talking about how in this world people have trouble figuring out what's true and what's false. So why don't we apply this to a different commandment? You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. Exodus 20, verse 16. How well have we learned the ninth commandment? Now, we said the most fundamental areas, we look at knowledge. The most fundamental area that's involved in knowledge, if a child were trying to learn something about the ninth commandment, we'd probably have them, first of all, memorize it. That's a good start. And sometimes, you know, we've perhaps been embarrassed. I've seen those situations where a minister may stand up and say, okay, we're going to have a quick test. What I want you to do is list in short form, in order, the Ten Commandments. And a lot of people have trouble doing that. Wow. If we haven't even memorized them, how do we really think we know them? So memorizing is a good way to start, because if you don't remember it's one of God's commandments and exactly what it says, it's easy to disobey it. Now, just as an insertion, and I'm not going to turn away, but as an insertion, this might be a good place to remind ourselves of God's instruction in Deuteronomy 4 and verse 2. You shall not add to the word which I command you, nor take from it, that you may keep the commandments of the Lord your God, which I command you. So we don't need to add to or take away. That's not what we're trying to do. That's not what knowledge involves. So we begin by memorizing. Okay, good start. But we recognize that's not enough. I want to learn more. So how do I grow in that? Well, the next level would encourage you to just simply rephrase it. Put it in your own words. Okay, how about, don't say anything deceptive about someone. Okay, that captures the basic concept. That's fine. It's not just spitting back the memorized thing. It's a little bit more to it. The next step is, at the next highest level, you probably would try to apply that commandment to a real life situation. Let's say, for example, your wife says, is this dress too tight? Okay. Is it okay to tell her that it's fine so she'll feel good even though you know it isn't true? No, actually. I know my wife and I talked about that jokingly one time. I heard a fellow's response was, his wife said, does this dress make me look fatter? And his response was, I've seen fatter. Okay, not a good response, no. But my wife and I were talking about it, and she said, you know, if I ever ask you if something looks right, I'm counting on you to tell me the truth. Because I don't want to go out of the house looking in a way that's embarrassed. I don't want to look that way. And even if it's a painful truth, I still want to know the truth. And so, okay, there's a real-life situation. Don't bear false witness. At the next level, the student might try to analyze the commandment by asking, okay, why does God give this command? Now, I did this in a Bible study a while back with a group of young adults, and I was a little disappointed, though I think as we think about it, I guess it takes a certain level of maturity to start asking some of these questions, but I think it's really helpful to look at all the commandments and say, why is this a commandment? Why did God make this one of the Ten Commandments? Why is this so important? So we might ask ourselves, well, what's so bad about saying something about someone else that isn't true? And how would my saying something false about someone else affect me? Now, of course, the truth is that no human relationship, marriage, family, church, can properly survive and function if one of the people in that relationship is not honest. Truth is absolutely essential. At the next level, we have two levels, and these two can kind of flip around depending on what you're reading. But at the next level, the student might consider the various forms false witness can take. Well, you hear two of your friends talking about someone who isn't there, and one of them says something that you know isn't true. If you say nothing, they will assume you agree. So what should you do? Can you be guilty of bearing false witness when you haven't said anything? If we don't actually tell a lie, but we give a false impression, have we violated this commandment? How would you explain to someone else why they should not repeat unfounded gossip, or why they should be careful about what they post on social media? At the highest level of knowledge of that commandment, a person may evaluate what kind of relationship he or she should have with someone who violates this commandment. If this person will say false things to others, can I trust them? If I say false things to others, can people trust me? You see, there's a lot more to that commandment than just memorizing it, being able to put it back down in order on a piece of paper. There's a lot more to understanding it. Now, all we've looked at that point is the knowledge area. What about values? It would be nice if we could work through all the stages there, but we don't have the time. That's all right. But in the area of values, we have to ask yourself how important this knowledge needs to be to you. How important is it to me that God says, don't bear false witness, and all the ramifications that that commandment has? At the very lowest level, under values, what people would do is, well, they'd be kind of willing to listen and consider a little bit. But as you move forward, it becomes more and more important. As you place more value on it, it becomes more important in your life. And at the highest level of the values area, a person is determined that this characteristic will be one of the core values of my life. Is the ninth commandment one of the core values of your life? If you come to that level of valuing that commandment, do you know someone who knows it's wrong to lie, but they do it anyway? We know that much of what we hear in the political campaigns is half-truth and distortion. The bottom line on values is simple. What kind of a person do I choose to be? How important will it be to me to be known as a person whose word can be trusted, a person who always speaks the truth? That's all a part of learning the ninth commandment. And in the area of actions, again, there are all kinds of different levels, but basically what it boils down to is we need to consider, how do we apply this commandment? Will I avoid lying by just not saying anything? What will I do if I hear a falsehood? And if I inadvertently say something that's not true, what will I do to make things right? That's all a part of learning and knowing and understanding the ninth commandment. Now, we can work through all of them that way. And we should. We should. So when you look at the ninth commandment in that way, how well do you know that commandment? Are you ready to teach it to others? Learning at that level requires time. In the field of education, it's often said it takes 3 years for a teacher to feel comfortable with the subject matter. And I think most of us who teach have found that to be true. It does. It takes time to get on top of that material so you feel comfortable with it. The fact that it takes time to learn is not the problem. The problem arises when we cease learning. When we figure we know enough and we don't need to learn anymore. Now, you may not have thought about it this way, but I'd like to just refer back to a passage we read the other day in 1 Kings chapter 3. 1 Kings chapter 3. It is the passage where Solomon asked God for a blessing at Gibeon. But I want to focus on one thing that's a little bit different here, that perhaps, again, it's easy to overlook. It's verse 6. 1 Kings 3, verse 6. Solomon said, You've shown great mercy to your servant David, my father, because he walked before you in truth, in righteousness, and in uprightness of heart with you. You note those three things? Truth. That's knowledge. That's the knowledge area. David had the knowledge. Righteousness refers to the right actions, and uprightness of heart refers to the right values. David knew God's way. David understood it on all the levels. So where do we go from here? Well, at this point, we could easily insert dozens of scriptures that talk about seeking wisdom, praying for increased knowledge, growing in godly discernment. The list could be almost endless. And they are all valid and important. But I want to wrap it up with just two brief passages. Proverbs 16 and verse 21. Consider this as a potential teacher. Proverbs 16, verse 21. The wise in heart will be called prudent, and sweetness of the lips increases learning. What does that mean? Well, let me give you a different translation, the contemporary English version. Good judgment proves that you're wise, and if you speak kindly, you can teach others. Teaching, helping others to understand, it's not something that comes from issuing decrees. There's a kindness that comes from experience. A kindness that comes from understanding what it takes to learn. A kindness that comes from recognizing how easy it is for Satan to deceive us and the damage that he can do, and being patient with people as a result. After the events leading up to Jesus Christ's return, and the forcible eviction of the spiritual ruler of today's world, everything we know of as civilization will lie in a heap at our feet. The task of rebuilding and restoration will appear impossible through human eyes. But we will no longer be limited by human eyes. The human survivors will need and will be given a new hope. A hope that rests upon the perfect, unshakable character and promises of God. Mankind will finally be so humbled that everyone will be ready to be taught a new way of living. And we're the ones who have the amazing privilege of teaching them that new way. If you've had children, think about how excited they get when you teach them how to do something they didn't know before. They can hardly wait to go show somebody else what they've learned. It's exciting, and that's good. You are patient with them. You encourage them along the way. Some of you are amazing. I don't know how to tie shoes. I mean, I tie mine, but if I had to teach somebody how to do it, I have no idea. But some of you have taught your children how to do it. The rabbit goes through the hole. I don't know how that works. But you're amazing teachers. You've taught your children amazing things. And not only that, but if you're teaching your children something that's important to you, think how rewarding that is when it becomes something they get excited about as well. So if you think about it, just as Mr. Johnson said yesterday, using slightly different words, teaching is not new to you. You've already been doing it. You are already a veteran teacher. God's going to give you a new classroom and new students, and it's really important that you master the subject matter before the first day of class. So when you get home from the feast, crack those books, make sure you're ready to share what God's given you. Those who have goals in life often place inspiring quotes where they can see them and be continually reminded of where they're going and why. Therefore, let's set these words before ourselves. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. That's where we must begin, and that's where the world ahead of us must begin. Please turn to Proverbs 2. I want to pick it up in verse 1. Proverbs 2, verse 1. It's an amazing promise and one that we all really, really need. Proverbs 2, verse 1. My son, If you receive my words and treasure my commands within you, so that you incline your ear to wisdom and apply your heart to understanding. Yes, if you cry out for discernment and lift up your voice for understanding, if you seek her as silver and search for her as for hidden treasure, then you will understand the fear of the Lord and find the knowledge of God. For the Lord gives wisdom. From his mouth come knowledge and understanding.